Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. I'm a little under the weather this week, Craig, and candidly, if this wasn't the subject, I may have called in a replacement. But this is a topic, since we began this podcast back in June of 2020, I've wanted to do. You know, when we started doing this, this would have been a top 10 to-do list for me. We're going back to August 24th, 1992, Hurricane Andrew.
Yeah, it was, and it, you know, people in South Florida still talk about it as being the big one, the one that actually hit South Florida and really, really caused major damage and major trauma for people there. And there are people there that are still dealing with it all these years later.
Yeah. Another Miami, you know, esque episode. And as we, you know, put, you know, in 150, 160, we'll get to 200, 250, however many episodes of this podcast we end up doing. This is one of those critical puzzle pieces. You know, this is like a corner piece. So, you know, you cannot tell the story of Florida without the story of Hurricane Andrew. And that's what we're going to do today as hurricane season is now here in Florida, June through October. And that reminds us that Welcome to Florida, once again, is presented by Windstorm Products. Windstorm Products is the world's largest online distributor of hurricane hardware. Whether your home is wood, concrete, brick, they've got the hurricane hardware you need for your storm shutters. They've got all the bolts and nuts, and they've also got the expertise in the right-hand corner, upper right-hand corner. I am the last DIY person in the world. I can barely screw in a screw or put in a light bulb or, you know, do anything. But I live here at the beach on Amelia Island, and I've called that 800 number and talked to the people at Windstorm Products. Say, here's where I live. Here's the direction my house faces. Here's how the wind comes in. Here's where my windows are. Here's where I've had water inundation in the past. They know how to help you. Windstormproducts.com, one-stop shop for hurricane hardware. Windstorm Products helps you weather any storm. Hurricane Andrew was not just any storm.
No, no. And one of the most telling things about it is that it was initially classified as a Category 4 storm because the wind was so strong, it actually blew the instruments off the National Weather Service headquarters in Miami. And so they had to go back years later and calculate and figure out. And finally, they said, yes, the wind was so strong, it was definitely a Category 5, and they reclassified it. I don't know of another hurricane they've had to do that with.
60 to 100 fatalities somewhere in there, a lingering death toll far, far greater.
Yeah.
A quarter of a million people left homeless, a million buildings damaged, probably more. I mean, you'll have 50, 60 billion in property damage. Our guest today lived through Hurricane Andrew. He was there. He was a University of Miami professor where he served for nearly 40 years. He wrote a book, a series of books, actually, the most prominent of them being In the Eye of Hurricane Andrew. It's been over 30 years now, just over 30 years, but Eugene Provenzo is going to go back in time with us to those frightful moments and then the hours, days, and weeks following Hurricane Andrew.
Eugene, thanks so much for joining us today. This is such an important topic, and I feel like so many people who have moved to Florida recently don't know anything about Hurricane Andrew, don't know about what it did to Florida, what a change it made. Were people prepared for anything like this to happen?
No, absolutely not. It was of a far greater magnitude, and it was a very different type of storm than anything that had previously hit South Florida and the rest of the country.
How do you mean different?
It was a much tighter storm. It was normally these storms come in and they broadcast themselves over a fairly wide area. And Andrew basically kept itself within anything from a 6 to 12 mile wide area. But it was very intense. And there was a tremendous amount of cyclonic activity within the storm. So there were these micro storms that went through neighborhoods and where there was relatively little damage short distance away, there's much greater damage hitting places because of these smaller storms. Microburst is the term, I think, that they used for them.
Yeah. 1992 obviously didn't have the technology, meteorological advances of 2023. At the same time, we're not watching black and white televisions. When did, I mean, there, so there was awareness that the storm was coming. When did the magnitude become realized and people start thinking, this is much worse than what we were being told to expect?
Sunday night. And what happened was, you've got a couple of broadcast people like Brian Norcross, who was a weatherman from South Florida that played a really prominent role in terms of reporting the storm. And he's just said to me, he didn't quote something to the effect of, people, it's going to be a lot worse than anything we had anticipated. So it was on Sunday night. Now, people like myself, and we weren't atypical, were preparing. I was putting up storm shutters on Saturday and basically took the entire day to do it. Mm. And then, you know, we just sort of waited it out. But it hit South Florida, if I remember correctly, about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. And you didn't really get a sense of how bad it was. Well, you did. I should qualify that. You didn't realize how bad it was until the light came up. But I sat hunkered down with my wife and a couple of cats and a colleague in an inner hallway as toys were being levitated or lifted off of the shelves. We have a toy collection, large toy collection. And we had wind-up toys that were going up into the air. And
wow.
We had an attic door that was, you know, one of those pull-down doors going up into the airspace. And it was bumping up and down. So it was literally raising up, 5-6 inches. It just almost flipped out. Gosh. In addition to that, we could feel the roof being stressed, and we were afraid the roof was going to go. We were lucky it didn't. We did have a major, for example, in my house, a very large crack where there was obviously stress put on the roof. The roof was literally acting as a, quote, aeroplane.
Wow.
You know, we were in the worst part of the storm, but the best part of the worst part of the storm, which is to say 168-mile-an-hour winds through the neighborhood. They were recorded at the National Hurricane Center, which was about 3 blocks from our house. And it started getting really bad after that. So we were not anywhere near as badly affected as people we interviewed and that I know for various reasons farther south.
Of all the folks you talked to about it, who do you think had the worst hurricane story? Who had the worst experience?
I've actually marked the book in a couple of places, and I've got a quote from my department chairman. I was in the School of Education, Department of Teaching and Learning for years at my University of Miami. Anyways, I have a very interesting quote from, okay, this is Karen Baldwin, who is a teacher in Dade County. Her husband was a university professor at the University of Miami. We could hear the screen patio tearing away from the back of the house. We could actually hear the metal bending and ripping. Attempting to open up or close any interior doors after 4 o'clock in the morning was incredibly difficult to do. Probably the height of the storm hit at 5 o'clock. I was scared. I've never been so scared in my life. I realized I was sitting in the room shaking. At least I thought I was shaking. And then I kind of took a deep breath and realized that it wasn't me shaking. It was the wall behind me that was literally moving back and forth, almost vibrating. At that point, someone on the radio said, if you don't feel secure where you are, you might want to seek an interior hallway in the window in the house with no windows. So I announced this to Doug and Scott, her son and husband, and we no sooner got the door open and the wind literally threw Scott across the room. As we went out of the living room, the living room door flew, at which point all three of the French doors in the back of the house broke. We literally crawled back to the bedroom, got the door closed again, pushed the dresser back up against the door, and we were frantically trying to close the outside French doors into the bedroom. They'd blown out, and we were holding onto the doors, trying to hold them closed. It was impossible. Between the three of us, we could not get them closed. Mm. Going a little farther ahead in her quote, continued. I opened the bedroom door to check on the front doors. This was probably the height of stupidity for the evening. The whole force of the storm was coming through our front doors. I decided I had to go close the front doors. So I went over to the doors and I tried to get the one door closed. And I got it two-thirds closed and I had to reach over to get the other door. So I'm standing kind of almost spread eagle in the doorway. And of course, all the wind and rain and everything else was coming in through the doors. It was as if I was flying between the wind and the water. The wind just took me and literally pushed me backward toward the wall in the dining room. It probably was just only about 10 feet. It was very surreal. The whole thing was surreal. I could see the doors, the wind and the water coming in. And there I was, just slowly moving backwards with the force of the wind and the water.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Just amazing.
And we've got multiple descriptions. I mean, at pretty much a similar level.
What area got the worst damage?
Well, as I said, I lived very close to the University of Miami, which is, for people who aren't familiar with it, is in South Coral Gables. Basically, it was really bad where we were, and we were at the edge of the worst part that where I lived, which was just a mile from the university. The area that I just described, or, you know, the worst area, was about 5 to 6 miles farther south, and it's all relative. I went out and started doing research and helping people cover their houses with tarps and things like that the day after the storm. And there literally, I went all the way down to Homestead, which is about 25 to 30 miles away, straight down US 1 going towards Key West. I did not see a single intact roof for that entire driving distance for any house.
Wow.
And so the area where I just described with the Baldwins was about 6-7 miles south, and it was just devastating there. And it was a lot of these microburst cyclonic winds coming in and just tearing things apart. I was down with them a couple of days after the storm. I didn't go immediately. I couldn't get in. They wouldn't, the police and so forth wouldn't allow you into the neighborhoods. They were literally torn apart. The house was standing, but the windows were pretty much out. And all the interior was gone. And there had been a flood of tidal water through. They were relatively close to some canals. And it just blew all of the salt water into the house, which didn't seem that terrible as they pumped it out. It wasn't good. But what they didn't realize was that it was completely deteriorating or rotting out, corroding all of the particle board in the house and the kitchen and wood and anything like that. Right. So they basically stripped the house down to cinder blocks to rebuild it.
Yeah. Wow. You'd mentioned the hours and then days after. Obviously, power is out. Again, this is 1992. There is no internet. There are no cell phones. First responder service is stressed to the absolute max if they can get anywhere. You've got 250,000 people homeless. More than that, structural damage, roads impassable from down power lines and trees, you know, grocery stores are closed, gas stations are closed. What do you remember about those days immediately after and just trying to survive until you could get help or be helped or start putting some kind of, you know, building blocks of your life back together?
Well, for me personally, I'm a researcher scholar, and my way of coping with things is to learn something new. So I basically decided, and my wife encouraged me, it's very supportive, that if I wanted to go out and do some work with people and then collect data for what eventually grew into a couple of books, History of Hurricane Andrew, in general, which I did with my undergraduate and graduate students and with my wife, and then another book with Sandra Fratt on the recovery of community, the role of the schools in the recovery of the community. It's really hard to describe how catastrophic it was. I mean, I think it's rather akin to, what people must suffer through, you know, when they have life-threatening cancer and barely survive. I just went through a severe case of COVID with drug complications, and it started literally a year ago. And I was 5 days in the hospital and just about died from poisoning. It was the treatment I was getting for the COVID had conflicted with some drugs I take, medical drugs I take. Mm-hmm. And it was at that level, the sort of feeling that a year ago I was pretty sure I was going to die. And it was as weighing on you as that sort of thing. And it's hard to explain to people. I had my brother-in-law, who is less than tactful at times, is up in Boston, and he should know better. He's an MD, PhD researcher. And I talked to my sister finally, had a phone call with her. I think this was the 14th day after the storm. And I heard him say in the background, are those people still whining?
Oh, man.
And I'll never forgive him for it. I really won't. We had just gotten power back 4 days before. And you say, well, what does it mean to lose power for 10 days?
Huh.
South Florida.
Now, this air conditioning. No air conditioning in August. That's what that means.
No air conditioning.
Well, rotting food.
No air conditioning.
Sick
no
people.
Light.
Yeah.
You're in an urban area that's, you know, Miami is a safe, dangerous city, if you understand what I mean. You don't want to be there without light at night. And there were people out looting, lots of them. And we had numerous people drive up to the front of the house, and we made it very evident that we were in the house and, you know, not to be disturbed. There are also things like basic sewer shuts down. So there's a lot of septic tanks. We were on a septic tank in Coral Gables. That doesn't sound possible, but it was the case. You wouldn't think that the closest suburb to downtown Miami is still on septic tanks, but they are. Pumps didn't work. Wells didn't work. The wells were all electric around. They were contaminated anyways. So you're dealing with all those types of factors. And then there's the environment. And again, very difficult to describe to people, but essentially you're at one of the hotter part times of the year. You've just had all of your foliage blown away. All the buildings are green because they've been hit by plant material and the chlorophyll has exploded on the side of the walls. There is no dust or sort of reflective material to speak of in the sky that just blew it all out. My wife had pointed this out to me when we were talking about this morning, and I remembered now. The air was incredibly clear, but the problem is it also meant that the sun was incredibly intense.
Yeah.
So you had these very high temperatures, and then you're trying to clear debris away, and you've got people who are out who normally don't do things like move large tree limbs or cut them down by hand, or if they're using power saws, using them improperly. One of the biggest things that came up in terms of the local emergency room, they said they had all these people with power saws coming in who were basic, who didn't know how to run them, and the saws would buck on them, and they were coming in with injuries because of, you know, trying to cut trees down.
Right. Yeah. Chainsaw injuries.
Yeah. Chainsaw. And then things are dropping on them because they weren't cutting them properly. So they cut a limb and it would fall on them. And then you have no heat for food. So everything's sort of pick up where you can get it. Problems of getting enough drinking water. And then the crazy things that you wouldn't think of, like you don't have your clothes and you can't wash. You know, your clothes are pretty much wrecked up because you've been outside and one thing or another. But a lot of your clothes have disappeared. Because they went out with the wind. Then people, well-meaning, I think, maybe they were just trying to clear out their closets, but are sending all this stuff. This is what I saw in Homestead, these trailer tractor loads of clothes coming in from out of state. And they were literally things that hadn't been washed, hadn't been folded, just piled. And the idea was that these well-meaning northerners were sending all these clothes into Homestead. This is where I saw this. And you were supposed to go to these piles of basically people's cast-offs, smelly cast-offs, and, you know, start wearing these as you're part of the recovery.
Weren't there afternoon thunder showers, too? That's a typical part of summer in Florida.
Yes. So you had other storms coming in.
And holes in the roof. So you, things that might dry out in the morning, they get wet all over again in the afternoon.
Entirely. Exactly. So even in our case, we had a tile roof that got stressed out and started to leak. And there had been no problem with it before. But, you know, when it started raining again, we had to deal with it. And we were very lucky. You know, I've got to tell you, there was a phenomenon in the hurricane of people being farther south who'd been hit worse than we were, being really resentful of individuals who'd come out better. So most of our faculty at the university, and a lot of people I went down and met and helped with and interviewed, they knew we lived in the Gables, and they just assumed that we were having, you know, a much better time than them. But, you know, my thing was, it was like a car wreck. Everybody was in the car wreck together, the entire community. And some people, you know, broke both arms and both legs. And people like myself just broke an arm and a leg.
And 60 or some odd people died. And obviously the families affected in that way were changed forever. And a lot of people in poverty, you know, who didn't have the health insurance, who didn't have a steady job to go back to, you know, their recovery was years in coming, if ever. That's on an individual level, a personal level. And your book does a really nice job as an oral history of focusing on those personal stories. Broadly to South Florida, broadly to Miami, what changed as a result of Hurricane Andrew?
Well, on a short-term basis, there was definitely a sense of community that was greater. You got to know your neighbors. You didn't have any choice. They were out in the street with you. And we had in our particular neighborhood, we had an older woman who was given very little attention. She was very private, kind of isolated. And she kind of came out in the hurricane because she had a gas stove, propane gas stove. And that was the only thing you could get. It was the place you get a cup of coffee, and people would bring food in and cook it. There were a lot of barbecues that occurred, and it was that freezers were, you know, just without power. And let's take everything in the freezer out, and we'll eat incredibly well for a couple of days. You end up cooking everything. So there was a community sense that developed. I think your question was, how did the community change?
Or, right? You know, big picture. What changed? I mean, were there lessons learned? Was the building code updated? Was emergency service? You know, did anything meaningful improve subsequently in disaster relief or storms from this?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of things changed. One of them was that there was a population shift. And if I remember the numbers correctly, I think it was 125,000 and not, it was at least that number of people moved permanently out of South Florida.
Really?
Not South Florida, moved out of Dade County.
Okay.
I was going to say, didn't a lot of them move to Broward? They moved one county away?
Yeah. They also moved a lot out of the county, out of Southern Florida, but a lot moved to Broward. So it changed the demographics in terms of Broward. And this had a huge effect, for example, on Broward schools, because a lot of people who went to Broward went there so that they could enroll their kids in school. The schools in Broward all opened. And so they suddenly found themselves with this huge influx of kids that I think they did a pretty good job with it, but it was certainly stressful for them in terms of just physical bodies and shortage of teachers and so forth. So there was a lot of migration. I think that the poor were particularly affected long-term in ways that aren't really going to ever be properly recorded. For example, when Sandra Fratt and I did our interviews for the school book about the schools in the recovery, we found a family that was in the area just above Homestead. And there was essentially the story is that there was a grandmother who was keeping two kids, raising them, because mom had a drug addiction problem and dad had disappeared. And she had a small house, was sort of getting by, not having an easy life, but was really important for these kids and providing them stability and, you know, parenting. She died. And she didn't die, interestingly enough. It isn't the 60 or 100 people who died in the storm, okay? It's the hundreds, if not thousands, probably thousands, who died in the 3 or 4 months afterwards because stress. Of the stress. And she was one of the people who died because of the stress. She had a heart condition, and her house got totally mangled. You know, we had 30% increase in suicide by December, and that's when it really hit.
Wow.
So there was a t-shirt that went around that was incredibly cool. Well, I don't know if it was incredibly cool, but I liked it, which said, I survived Hurricane Andrew, but I was destroyed by the recovery, or you know, something to that effect. And I have to say that it took me, other than doing the history, basically about 6 months to get down to anything approaching normal in my life. And my wife and I don't have children. Our life is a lot easier than a lot of other people's.
Yeah. Yeah. Jobs, you're healthy. You know, the people like, you know, the lady you mentioned who are on the margins, anyone who lives hand to mouth, you know what a flat tire can mean to your life.
Exactly.
And the turmoil it can bring you, let alone having your house obliterated.
Yeah. But going beyond that, which is, I mean, that's absolutely the case and really interesting. But for example, something that I came to the conclusion of was that if, in terms of individuals, they all went down a notch or two, and I saw this with my colleagues, compared to how they function normally. So let's just say, for the sake of argument, I was a successful professional, got a good job, living with my wife, who's terrifically supportive. I'm operating in the A or A minus level, let's say. And I think that was probably accurate. I definitely went down to something approaching a B minus or C plus. Mm-hmm. And I was in the good group, okay? Now, you see, the other thing is, it's not just the recovery for yourself, but you've got to go back to your job. So one of the critical things that came up was, most of the teachers in Dade County live in the south part of the county because of housing costs. And that's where the worst part of the storm hit. And the same thing for policemen and firemen. So these are the service people. And they've all gone through the storm. They've all gotten creamed to various degrees. And then what is it that they have to do? They have to go out and start classes again with kids and help kids who are traumatized. They have to keep, you know, in terms of the fire and rescue people, you know, the firemen are trying to put up all the stop signs and all of the
traffic lights. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, literally, somebody told me that there was not a single stoplight that wasn't functional and didn't have to be repaired somehow in the entire southern part of the county. I suspect that was true. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know in my own case of teaching at the university, I had to deal with, I worked in the School of Education, and I, you know, had mostly teachers in my classes, and I had to deal with their being traumatized and providing services and getting them to do the work that they needed to do to keep, they didn't want to stop on their degrees. Mm-hmm. So that's how we came up with the idea for doing the oral histories, was I basically said, damn, I can't ask these people to go to the library and write term papers for me.
Yeah.
And we came up with the idea of, they did basically two finished interviews, each with an introduction, and they got to choose somebody that they really knew in the community and they, you know, was meaningful to them. Well, it's interesting from a methodological point of view, we got a much more interesting sample of people than we would have gotten if I'd just gone out on my own. So the African-American woman who I might have trouble approaching her grandmother and saying, how did you deal with, you know, how did you do in the storm? Because she would possibly see me as an outside authority figure and an individual who's white and different class and everything else. And you don't like to say that that's a reality, but that is a reality.
Sure.
But her granddaughter comes in and says, hey, I need to finish my project for Dr. Provenzo. Will you let me interview you? Oh, sure. You know, so we got all sorts of interesting results that we wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
One thing I read that the number of divorces suddenly spiked.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I've got some figures on that somewhere. Really significant. Like I said, it was like the suicide rate and the divorce rate really increased.
what were people fighting about? Were they fighting about the money from insurance, or how to, or whether to stay, or
not to play amateur psychologist here, Craig, but I think it's just the stress. You know, it's just the stress of, you know, we all view our home as our sanctuary. When you don't have a sanctuary to go home with, and you're constantly wrestling with contractors, and everything's wet and everything's moldy, and you don't have your stuff, and your routine has been turned upside down, who do you take out your frustrations on? The person right next to you.
I think it's exactly that. And I think it's also, if you've got a, let's say for the sake of argument, a problematic marriage.
Pressure burst pipes.
Problematic.
Yeah.
With this type of stuff. And I know in my own case, my wife and I have an unusually good relationship, and we don't have kids. And so we're not worrying about them. And I can remember the stress of, you know, just sort of, I mean, having to sit back and say things like, you know, I don't want to talk about it. It's, I know I'm not acting reasonably because of the hurricane. And a lot of people were able to bring it up to that higher level, relatively speaking. Yeah. Again, I think it's that notion of going from a, you know, and maybe an A or a B level down to a C or a D level, or maybe worse.
And imagine that, you know, it's just anyone who's gone through a home remodel, that's stressful enough, and it's planned. Yeah. And sure, you've still got air conditioning, everything is sorted out, and you've got the money to pay for it. But it's aggravating to have hammers going around and people in and out of the house. And again, your life is turned upside down because, you know, you've got sawhorses in the bedroom, and, you know, you got to go downstairs to use the toilet. You know, this is that times 100, and it wasn't expected. And, you know, you've got to go back to work, and maybe you know someone who died, or you've got a neighbor who died. Or, you know, I mean, the stress of these natural disasters and that human toll. And, you know, I'd never thought until you mentioned, Eugene, that vapor trail that these disasters leave behind them. You know, again, once the news crews have gone and Good Morning America is on to the next disaster,
right,
these people are still dealing with it. And all these disasters, whether they're, you know, floods along the Ohio River or wildfires in California, that's what we forget. Those people, these are months, if not years, in attempting to put their life back 85% of what it was, hopefully.
Yeah. Now, saying that, okay, and I am totally in agreement. You asked before about things like revising of building codes and so forth, which took place to a significant degree, so it shouldn't be as bad the next time. But there are also opportunities provided. For example, at University of Miami, the entire landscaping, which had been done late 70s, new president came in, Tad Foote, and really improved things a lot. But there were a lot of things that needed to be done better. And, you know, sort of the first stage of doing those improvements. They came in after the hurricane, and over a period of 3 or 4 years, literally rebuilt from a landscape point of view the entire campus, making it into, in my opinion, with a couple of new buildings, what had been what I used to refer to when I first arrived there in 76 as neo-fascist architecture. It was an early American motel. A lot of dreadful buildings that were put up after the Second World War very quickly. And they transformed it into, I haven't seen in recent years, I haven't been back to Miami since 2013. But by the time I left, and it started as a result of Hurricane Andrew, one of the more impressive garden campuses in the United States. And, you know, taking advantage of tropical plants and replanting and walkways and nonsense. It doesn't sound that important, but actually it reset the campus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think that probably happened in a lot of places.
There were some resets that were not so good. Homestead Air Force Base basically got shut down.
I wouldn't call that. Yeah, I've got the numbers on that are, what do you do with something like this? 8,700 people lost their jobs. 4,700 military were transferred, and that entire infrastructure, the infrastructure was gone in terms of social services. So things that you didn't think of, like military who used the commissary at Homestead Air Force Base. So you retire to South Florida, and you retire specifically to Homestead because houses are relatively cheap. The Air Force Base is nearby with its commissary, and I don't know what medical, but probably some medical. It's gone. And so you all of a sudden find yourself, I think the next major Air Force base is Central Florida. I'm not absolutely sure of that, but up near Canaveral. So you've been using the commissary and maybe you've been using some health services. And the closest hospital is a veterans hospital in downtown Miami. But you're potentially really screwed. And I think a lot of the people who left were the ex-military, that really significant migration out. So you've got this infrastructure that's provided by the airbase with jobs and all sorts of, you know, ancillary things. And then all of a sudden it's gone within a couple of years. They never reopened it. They kept on talking about reopening the base and they never did it.
What grade would you give city, state, county, the different municipalities, their federal government, as far as the recovery efforts go? This is clearly an all hands on deck situation. It's bigger than the city of Miami or Coral Gables.
Well, you say that, but then there's the Kate Hale incident. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, sure.
Kate Hale went on TV, what was it, 3 days, 4 days after the hurricane and said, "Where the hell is the cavalry?"
Yeah, that's right.
Meaning the federal response was.
And she's just a citizen there?
She was, what was her position with the county? I forget now.
But she said, yeah, where the hell is the cavalry? To answer the question from what I remember and what we wrote about, you had people like Mayor Clark in Miami, city of Miami. He just never appeared. He just went to his house and hid out.
Wow.
And, you know, just amazing nonsense like that. I think that the FEMA services arrived late, if I remember correctly, 5 to 6 days late. The National Guard came 5 to 6 days late. Eventually, 20,000 National Guard came down. And they were needed just to, you know, sort of do traffic control.
Yeah.
Keep people from looting, et cetera, et cetera. So the first couple of days there were pretty hairy. Now, I think personally on the National Guard, you could have mobilized them and had them ready to go in within a day or two if it had been handled better. FEMA in general, I think my sense is it was a really mixed bag. What I found ironic was that the independent services tended to do better. The Jehovah's Witnesses, believe it or not, they have a whole program of sending in relief to earthquake and hurricane areas. And they came down. They had their own trucks. They had their own trailers. They had their own food. When they went in, they were terrifically effective. And they were good with thousands of people. Huh. And Salvation Army was the same thing. FEMA eventually got organized. You know, I tend to believe that government should handle these things. And they don't handle them as well as I'd like.
They didn't handle this one very well. Kate Hale was the Dade County Emergency Manager and went on TV and said, you know, where the hell's the cavalry? Because there was no federal response at that point.
The recovery and the days after also, and I believe this was in Florida, correct, Craig, had an impact on the presidential race of 1992. Blimey. Wasn't that where Clinton went down there and did the handshaking and appeared very empathetic, and Bush, who was president at the time, was somewhat absent? And
that's right. Yeah, I'd completely forgotten that. Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, and you know, the thing is, the appearance of public officials like that, as you just brought back, I can see Clinton now all of a sudden doing that. It doesn't do much immediate good in terms of physically, but spiritually, and you know, in terms of building faith, I don't mean the religious sense. I think stuff's really important.
And speaking sort of to that National Guard FEMA absence, when you're in a situation like that, and I have never been in one, admittedly, it must be nice just to know people care, you know, and that here's one presidential candidate who changed his schedule to come here, while another didn't and is still stumping in Iowa or wherever the hell, while, you know, a major American city has been, it looks like Godzilla has gone through. And just the idea that, you know, people care, people are trying. And again, that was a Katrina thing, right? And, you know, most people, you know, many people, you know, Andrew's over 30 years ago. There are people listening to this podcast who were not alive when it happened, but everyone listening remembers Katrina. And there were people in New Orleans, rightly so, who thought, we have been forsaken. This is Thunderdome at this point. No one is coming. We are totally on our own. This is man eat man, dog eat dog, jungle rules apply here. So any signal from, you know, the federal government. That's why presidents go to disaster. What are they going to do? Joe Biden's not going to go saw a tree and, you know, clear a street for anyone. But it's meaningful in that, well, this at least they care enough to come here.
Yeah.
But when you compare that to, just got me so furious, Trump throwing the paper towels.
Oh, at the hurricane victims. Yeah,
to the hurricane victims. Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
So there he is. He's sitting there and he's supposedly, you know, being concerned about these people and he's tossing them towels. If he had done that to me, I would have taken one of them and whacked him over the head.
Yeah.
The Secret Service might not like that. So let me ask you, what did you start doing differently as a result of Hurricane Andrew? Did you change anything in your life or in your habits as a result in terms of hurricane preparation?
If we were still down there, having in a significant supply of water, decent food, and food that's really well thought out, so that, you know, it's something that you can make easily, but is also fun or a bit of a treat. I know that sounds silly, but when you're sitting there totally depressed, and, you know, a bag of M&Ms can cheer you up a bit. And I think it's more important, obviously, with kids.
Yeah.
I think all the usual stuff in terms of keeping batteries charged and multiple flashlights, large ones and small ones. I think if I were to still be down there, I would be getting a generator as a backup. The problem is, where do you put the damn thing? My house didn't have a garage, so we had a cottage, and what had been a garage was converted into a bedroom. So, you know, you've got the problem of what do you do with...
Where do you put it? Yeah. I would assume you'd want to have a grill so you could grill out when the power's out.
That's a good point, a grill. I think really carefully thought out changes of clothing and multiple ones, so that, for example, if you're sitting after a hurricane, I know this sounds kind of tacky, but if you're sitting after a hurricane and you're in your fifth day of recovery and you haven't had a bath and you're wearing the same underwear, a fresh pair of underwear.
Yeah.
And it's 90 degrees and you've been working all day to clear debris.
Yeah.
And the humidity is 90%.
I mean, you're starting to itch. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'm being gross, but it's really significant.
Yeah.
I mean, not just simply from a health and disease point of view, but just basic comfort.
Yeah.
And topping up the gas in your car. I think one of the issues I really like the idea of getting an electric car, but I would be somewhat concerned about having one in South Florida in terms of a hurricane. I mean, I think it's a lot more problematic. Getting to a gas station, we didn't discuss that. You know, we waited 40, 50 people in front of us in a line, not sure that the gas tanks weren't going to be empty going down the road. That was later. You know, we had filled up our tank prior to the storm, but this was like several weeks afterward. Now, if you imagine if you're driving, well, this would be the case with the service people. You're a City of Miami policeman. You're driving from Homestead to get to work, even a couple of weeks afterwards. That's 25, 30 miles. And you're having to stop for these incredibly long gas lines.
Yeah.
See, the problem was the gasoline was not only in short supply, the gas pumps were out because they'd been destroyed in the storm. Mm-hmm. So they had there was a lot of, it's coming back to me, but a lot of people were driving up to Broward in order to get gas. And, you know, so you're driving out of county in order to get gas because you can't get it locally.
One thing I have to ask, it's kind of a side issue, but there were reports of monkeys that got loose and other exotic creatures, and supposedly a big breeding facility for pythons was destroyed and they all scattered. Did you run across anything like that?
Oh, yes, we indeed. The monkeys definitely got loose, and that was a serious thing because there's a research primate lab run by the university in South County, and they eventually got them all together. They had to kill a lot of them. They had to shoot them. It's very sad. But the really funny, and I didn't have too much contact with that, but I had direct contact, and it was wonderful. It was so much fun. The flight cage at the Miami Zoo blew open.
Oh, no.
So all the exotic birds got out.
Oh, no.
And a very large number of them came up to our street, up to our neighborhood. So we were getting these, it was terrific. There was everybody out in the world. There, all these people were out trying to catch them because they'd have these things like these scarlet macaws, these beautiful, huge birds. And they're worth, you know, $5,000 or $6,000, $7,000. And these were specimen birds, obviously. And there they were sitting, you know, munching on the coconuts, you know, in front of the house. They were wily. You couldn't catch them. You had kids coming out and all sorts of people chasing around with ladders and trying to climb up the trees. And the birds weren't going to have anything of it. And they tried netting them. But they eventually disappeared. I guess they went away after about a year.
Eugene Provenzo, the book is In the Eye of Hurricane Andrew. Thank you for reliving this traumatic period in your life for us. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Well, great to be able to speak with you. Thanks. Yes.
Thanks again. So I have to tell you my Hurricane Andrew experience. Mm-hmm. I was still somewhat new to the St. Petersburg Times at the time. And an editor called me in and said, look, we've got a team of people on the ground in Miami covering Hurricane Andrew right now. We want you to go in with the second team and you'll be covering daily stuff. But I want you, in addition, to do two long-term jobs. I want you to find a middle-class family and a poor family and write about what their life is like now, but then also arrange to go back and see them again at 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and a year. And mm-hmm. then I want you to pick a neighborhood, just a typical neighborhood, and do the same thing where you go back over the course of a year. So I did that. And the folks I picked out, the middle-class family and the poor family, things went very badly for them in that year after the storm.
Give me one example. Yeah.
The middle class couple wound up splitting up. They wound up getting divorced, and they got to the point where they didn't want to take my phone calls anymore because it was so bad between them.
Yeah.
And the poor family had lots of problems, but it seemed to make their relationship stronger.
Hmm.
And then the neighborhood, and this is the one that really kind of affected me more. It was this cul-de-sac near Homestead Air Force Base, and as Eugene mentioned, it was people who depended on the Air Force Base being there for them to be there. And when the Air Force Base shut down, it kind of messed a whole lot of things up for their lives. But they all kind of pulled together. They all helped each other out. You know, there was one guy who had a car that was working, and so he'd give people rides to different places, and then they'd give him money for the gas. Mm-hmm. There was somebody who cooked out. But the amazing thing to me is, you know, that story was being duplicated all over the landscape. Sure. That, you know, and part of the problem was even getting out of the neighborhood, they didn't know where things were because all the street signs had been blown down and you couldn't even know where you were going.
Yeah.
You'd start out one place and you'd wind up 3 miles away from where you were intending to go because you made a series of wrong turns. It was stripping back the layer of civilization that was on South Florida and turning it into a sort of a dog eat dog society. But some people managed to make it through that. I went back 10 years later to talk to people in that neighborhood, mm-hmm. and they were still dealing with the trauma of it. One guy told me every time he sees the sky cloud up, he starts looking for a place to hide. It was just amazing.
This is, you know, the old cliche, you know, it's a war zone. This was like going, you know, you don't want to use, it was like a bombing raid. You know, this was World War II. This was Dresden. This was the Blitz over London. You don't just move past that. You know, we heard Eugene talking about, you know, objects levitating in his house from the wind and the barometric pressure, and the home is shaking. And think of the fear. You know, this is all happening at night. Okay, it's dark. You've got kids. They're crying. Think of what your dog is barking. Think of the noises, you know, all of this, you know, that is a difficult thing to go to. And post-traumatic stress disorder is real, not only in war zones, but in natural disasters like this as well. You never, ever forget this kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.